Hey, everybody, it's Rob. Hey, I just wanted to let you know, with this episode and possibly the last one and maybe the next one, we're going to be dealing with a lot of names that are going to be very difficult for me to pronounce. So keep in mind that I was in the generation of Hooked on Phonics, so I actually sound things out. So no disrespect intended. It's just the fact that, you know, I'm just this old man from the Midwest that, quite frankly, I just can't pronounce some people's names. And welcome back. We are continuing our focus in on mobsters, hitmen, really fascinating guys. So this week, John Gotti. So John Joseph Gotti Jr. was an American gangster and the boss of the Gambino crime family in New York. He ordered and helped to orchestrate the murder of Gambino boss Paul Castellano in 85. And he took over the family shortly thereafter, becoming boss of what was described as America's first most powerful crime syndicate. Following the FBI indictments of members of Gotti's crew for selling narcotics, Gotti began to fear that he and his brother would be killed by Castellano for dealing drugs. As this fear continued to grow amidst growing dissent over leadership of the crime family, Gotti organized the murder of Castellano. At his peak, Gotti was one of the most powerful and dangerous crime bosses in the U.S. During his era, he became widely known for his outspoken personality and flamboyant style. Yeah, I remember, you know, you looked at him, you're like, ah, oh, damn right, man, that guy is dressing good. While his peers generally avoided attracting attention, especially from the media, Gotti became known as the Dapper Don for his expensive clothes and personality in front of the cameras. He was later given the nickname the Teflon Don after three high-profile trials in the 80s resulted in his acquittal. Gotti's underboss, Salvatore Sammy the Bull Gravano, aided the FBI in convicting Gotti in 91. You know, sometimes you just can't trust. Gravano agreed to turn state's evidence and testify against Gotti after hearing the boss make disparaging remarks about him on a wiretap that implicated them both in several murders. In 1992, Gotti was convicted of five murders, conspiracy to commit murder, racketeering, obstruction of justice, tax evasion, illegal gambling, extortion, and loan sharking. He received life in prison without parole and was transferred to United States Penitentiary Marin. Gotti died of throat cancer on June 10, 2002, in the medical facility for federal prisoners in Springfield, Missouri. According to Gaspipe Casso, the former underboss of the Lucchese family, he said, quote, "What John Gotti did was the beginning of the end of the Cosa Nostra." I would agree with that. In his teens, John Gotti began running errands for Carmen Fatico, a captain in the Gambino family and then known as the Anastasia family, under the leadership of boss Albert Anastasia. Gotti carried out truck hijackings at JFK, former Idlewild Airport, together with his brother Eugene and friend Ruggiero. In February of 68, United Airline employees identified Gotti as the man who signed for stolen merchandise. The FBI arrested him for that hijacking soon thereafter. Gotti was arrested for a third time for hijacking While out on bail 2 months later, this time for stealing a load of cigarettes worth $50,000. Keep in mind, that was in 1968. I mean, cigarettes were like 15 cents a pack. Later that year, Gotti pled guilty to the Northwest Airlines hijacking and was sentenced to 3 years. Gotti got paroled in 72. Gotti was then transferred to management of the Bergen crew's illegal gambling, where he proved himself to be an efficient enforcer. Fatico was indicted on loan sharking charges in 72. As a condition of his release, he could not associate with known felons. Gotti was not yet a made man in the mafia. Fatico named him being the acting captain of the Bergen crew soon after he was paroled. In this new role, John Gotti frequently traveled to Delacroix's headquarters, who already had taken a liking to Gotti, and he would brief the underboss of the crew's activities. The two of them were very similar. Both had strong violent streaks, cursed a lot, and were heavy gamblers. After Emmanuel Gambino, nephew to boss Carlo Gambino, was kidnapped and murdered in 73, Gotti was assigned to the hit team alongside Ruggiero and Ralph Gallone to search for the main suspect, gangster James McBratney. The team botched their attempt to abduct McBratney at a Staten Island bar when they attempted to arrest him while posing as detectives. And Gallone shot McBratney dead when his accomplices managed to restrain him. Gotti was then identified by eyewitness and a police insider and was arrested for the killing in 74. So far, I don't see him being very successful. He was able to strike a plea bargain, however, with the help of attorney Roy Cohn, and was sentenced to 4 years in prison for attempted manslaughter for his part on the hit. In 1976, Carlo Gambino died at his home from natural causes. Against expectations, he appointed Castellano to succeed him over his underboss, Delacroix. Gambino appeared to believe that the crime family would benefit from Castellano's focus on white-collar business. Delacroix, at the time, was in prison for tax evasion and was unable to contest Castellano's succession. Castellano arranged for Delacroix to remain as an underboss while directly running traditional Costa Nostra activities such as extortion, robbery, and loan sharking. While Delacroix accepted Castellano's succession, the deal effectively split the Gambino family into two rival factions. Gotti was then released in 77 after 2 years of imprisonment and was subsequently initiated as a made man into the Gambino family, now under the command of Castellano. And he was immediately promoted to replace Fatico as captain of the Bergen crew. He and his crew reported directly to Delacroix as part of his concessions given by Castellano to keep Delacroix as an underboss, and Gotti was regarded as Delacroix's protege. Under Gotti, the crew were Delacroix's biggest earners. Gotti tried to keep most of his personal life out of his life of crime, and never the two should meet. However, with the exception of his son John, Angelo Gotti, who was a mob associate by 1982. In December of 78, Gotti assisted in the largest recovery cash robbery in the history, the infamous Lithuania heist at Kennedy Airport. Gotti had made arrangements for the getaway van and to be crushed and bailed at the scrapyard in Brooklyn. Gotti's cut of the heist was reported to be $200,000. The driver of the van, Parnell Stacks Edward, failed to follow orders. Rather than driving the vehicle to a scrapyard, he parked it near a fire hydrant and went to sleep at his girlfriend's apartment. The NYPD, they recovered the van, lifted his fingerprints of several perpetrators of the robbery, helping to unravel the heist. In 1980, Gotti's youngest son, 12-year-old Frank Gotti, was run over and killed on a family friend's motorbike named by a neighbor of John Favara. Frank's death was ruled as an accident, but Favara subsequently received death threats and was attacked by Victoria with a baseball bat when he visited the Gottis to apologize. In 1980, Favara was abducted and disappeared, presumed murdered. Gotti is widely assumed to have ordered the murder despite him and his family leaving on vacation 3 days before the murder. Gotti was indicted on two occasions in his last 2 years as the captain of the Bergen Gang, with the cases coming to trial after his ascension to the boss of the Gambinos. In 1985, he was indicted alongside De La Cruz for several Bergen crew members in a racketeering case by the U.S. attorney Diane Giacalone. The indictment revealed that Gotti's friend and co-defendant, Wilfred Willie Boy Johnson, had been a FBI informant. Gotti rapidly became dissatisfied with Castellano's leadership, regarding the new boss as being too isolated and greedy. Like other members of the family, Gotti also personally disliked Castellano. The boss lacked street cred. I should never say that. Street credibility. And those who paid their dues running street-level jobs did not respect him. Gotti had an economic interest. He had a running dispute with Castellano on the split that Gotti took from the hijackings at Kennedy Airport. Gotti was also rumored to be expanding into drug dealing, a lucrative trade Castellano had banned. In 1983, Ruggiero and Gene Gotti were arrested for dealing heroin, based primarily on recordings from a bug in Ruggiero's house. Castellano, who banned made men from his family from dealing drugs under threat of death, demanding transcripts of the tapes, and when Ruggiero refused, he threatened to demote Gotti. In 1984, Castellano was arrested and indicted in a RICO case for the crimes of the Gambino hitmen, Roy DeMeo's crew. And as you learned last week or the week before, that was the Iceman. He worked for Roy DeMeo. The following year, he received a second indictment for his role in the Mafia's commission, facing life imprisonment, or for either case, Castellano arranged for Gotti to serve as acting boss alongside Thomas Bilotti, Castellano's favorite captain, and Thomas Gambino in his absence. Gotti, meanwhile, began conspiring with fellow disgruntled captains Frank DeChico and Joseph Joe Penny Armone and soldiers Sammy Gravano. Don't trust Sammy. I know where this is going. Don't do it, John. And Robert Dib DiBerno, collectively dubbed the Fist by themselves, to overthrow Castellano, insisting, despite the boss's inaction, that Castellano would eventually try to kill him. It had been a long rule in the Mafia that a boss could only be killed with the approval of the majority of the commission. Indeed, Gotti's planned hit would have been the first unsanctioned hit on a boss since Frank Costello was nearly killed in 57. Gotti knew that it would be too risky to solicit support from the other four bosses since they had long-standing ties with Castellano. To get around this, he got support of several important figures in his generation of the Lucchese, Colombo, and Bonanno families. He did not consider approaching the Genovese family. Castellano's ties with the Genovese Vincent Chin Gigante were so close that any overture to a Genovese soldier would have been a tip-off. However, Gotti could count on the complicity of the Gambino concierge, Joseph Gallo. After De La Cruz died of cancer in 85, Castellano revised his succession plan, appointing Bilotti as underboss to Thomas Gambino as the sole acting boss. Appointing Bilotti as underboss to Thomas Gambino as the sole acting boss while making plans to break up Gotti's crew. Infuriated by this and Castellano's refusal to attend De La Cruz's wake, Gotti resolved to kill his boss. When DiCicco tipped off Gotti that he would be having a meeting with Castellano and several other Gambino mobsters at Sparks Steakhouse on December 16th, 1985. Gotti chose to take this opportunity. Both the boss and the underboss were ambushed and shot dead by assassins under Gotti's command when they arrived at the meeting in the evening. Gotti watched the hit from his car with Gravano. Several days after the murder, Gotti was named to a three-man committee temporarily running the family pending the election of a new boss along with Gallo and DiCicco. It was also announced that an internal investigation into Castellano's murder was underway. However, it was an open secret that Gotti was acting boss in all but name, and nearly all of the family's captains knew he was the one who was behind the hit. He was formally acclaimed as the new boss of the Gambino family at a meeting of the 20 captains held in 1986. He appointed DiCicco as his new underboss while retaining Gallo as concierge. Identified as both Castellano's likely murderer and his successor, Gotti rose to fame throughout 1986. At the time of his takeover, the Gambino family was regarded as the most powerful American mafia family with an annual income of over $500 million. Gotti, well, he often smiled and waved at television cameras at his trials, which gained him favor with some of the public. Gotti's newfound fame had at least one positive effect. Upon the revelation of his attacker's occupation and amid reports of intimidation by the Gambinos, Romil Pichek, and I know I probably mispronounced that, but we're going to go with it, decided not to testify against Gotti, thanks to Bosco the Yugo Rejnik, yeah, I'm going to go with that, the head of the Westies in Hell's Kitchen, Manhattan. When his trial began in 1986, Pichek testified he was unable to remember who attacked him. The case was promptly dismissed, with the New York Post summarizing the proceedings with the headline, "I forgot he." That's funny. That's funny right there. It was later revealed that Gambino thugs had severed Pichek's brake lines and made threatening phone calls and stalked him before the trial. In 1986, DiCicco was killed when his car was bombed following a visit to Castellano's loyalist, James Faglia. The bombing was carried out by Victor Amuso and Anthony Casso of the Lucchese family under orders of Giganti and Lucchese boss Anthony Corallo, and to avenge Castellano and Bellotti by killing their successors. Gotti also planned to visit Faglia that day, but canceled. The bomb was detonated after a soldier who rode with DiCicco was mistaken for the boss. Bombs had long been banned by the mafia out of concern that it would put innocent people in harm's way, leading the Gambinos to initially suspect that, quote, Zips, the Sicilian mafioso working in the U.S., were behind it. Zips were well known for using bombs. In March of 1987, they acquitted Gotti and his co-defendants of all charges, including the loan sharking, illegal gambling, murder, and armed hijackings. In the face of the previous mafia convictions, particularly the success of the Mafia Commission trial, Gotti's acquittal was a major upset that further added to his reputation. The American media dubbed Gotti the Teflon Don in reference to the failure of any charges to stick. While Gotti himself had escaped conviction, his associates were not quite so fortunate. The other two men in the Gambino administration, underboss Armone and concierge Gallo, had been indicted on racketeering charges in 86 and were both convicted in 87. The heroin trial of Gotti's former fellow Bergen crew member Ruggero and Gene Gotti also commenced in June of that year. Prior to their convictions, Gotti allowed Gallo to retire and promoted Gravano in his place while slating Frank Locascio to serve as acting underboss in the event of Armone's imprisonment. During 1988, Gotti, against Gravano's advice, required his captains to meet with him at Raven Knight Social Club once a week. Regarded by Gene as an unnecessary vanity-inspired risk, and by FBI Gambino squad leader Bruce Mao as antithetical to the secret society, this move allowed the FBI to surveil and record and identify much of the Gambino hierarchy. It also provided strong circumstantial evidence that Gotti was a boss. Long-standing protocol in the mafia required public demonstrations of loyalty to the boss. The FBI also bugged the Ravenite, but failed to produce any high-quality incriminating recordings. Later in 1988, Gotti, Gianti, and the new Lachese boss, Victor Amuso, attended first commission meeting at the LaBar Bat Club in Manhattan since the commission trial. The following year, the FBI warned Gotti that they had recorded Genovese concierge Louis Manna discussing another hit on Gotti and his brother. In order to avoid a war, the leaders of the three families met, denied knowledge of their violence against one another, and agreed to communicate better. Gotti's son, John Gotti Jr., was initiated into the Gambino family on Christmas Eve, 1988. Some people were dreaming of a white Christmas, and they were dreaming of something else. So there you go. Merry Christmas. According to fellow mobster Michael DeLeonardo, initiated on the same night, Gravano held the ceremony to keep Gotti from being accused of nepotism. John Jr. was promoted to captain promptly. On the evening of January 23, 1989, Gotti was arrested outside the Ravenite and charged with ordering the 1986 assault of labor union official John O'Connor. In the back of the police car, Gotti remarked, 3-1, I beat this charge. By the time the FBI had cultivated new informants and learned part of the reason of the Ravenite bug failed, was that Gotti would hold sensitive conversations in the rear hallway in the building, the club occupied, or in an apartment in its upper floors, where a friendly widow of a Gambino soldier lived, and by 1989 both locations were bugged. The apartment bug was partially fruitful due to Gotti's frankness as he discussed his position as family boss in meetings there. In a December 12th conversation with Frank Locasio, Gotti plainly acknowledged ordering the murders of DiBernardo, Liborio, Milto, the latter being one of Gravano's partners, killed for insubordination. He also announced the intent to kill soldier Louis De Bono, who had ignored the summons to meet with Gotti to discuss his mismanagement of a drywall business which he held with Gotti and Gravano. The FBI, however, misheard the name drop and failed to warn DeBono, who was killed in October of 90. In another taped meeting in January of 90, Gotti promoted Gravano to underboss, preferring Gravano to lead the family if he was convicted in the assault case. State prosecutors linked Gotti to the case with a recording of him discussing O'Connor and announcing his intention to, quote, bust him up, end quote. And the testimony of Westies gangster James McElroy. However, Gotti was acquitted of all six assault and conspiracy charges at trial in February of 90. After the trial, there were firework displays by locals. The director of the FBI Organized Crime Division in New York stated, quote, with all this media coverage, he's beginning to look like a folk hero. What the people should realize is that he is the boss of the largest Cosa Nostra family that surrounds himself with ruthless killers and that he is flat out a criminal, end quote. It later emerged, however, that the FBI bugs had apparently caught Gotti discussing plans to fix the jury that he had in 86 and 87's racketeering cases. In December of 90, FBI agents and NYPD detectives raided the Ravenite, arresting Gotti, Gravano, and Frank Locasio. Federal prosecutors charged Gotti in this new racketeering case with five murders: Castellano, Bilotti, DiBernardo, Liberio, Milto, and, after review of the tapes, Louis De Bono. The conspiracy to murder Corky Vestola, a loan sharking, illegal gambling, obstruction of justice, bribery, and tax evasion. That's a mouthful. Based on the tapes the FBI bugs played at pretrial hearings, the Gambino administration was denied bail. At the same time, attorneys Coulter Cutler and Gerald Chargell were disqualified from defending Gotti and Gravano after prosecutors successfully contended that they were, quote, part of the evidence, end quote, and thus liable to be called as a witness. Prosecutors argued that Cutler and Chargell not only knew about potential crime activity, but had worked as in-house counsel for the Gambino family. Gotti subsequently hired Albert Krieger, a Miami attorney, who had worked with Joseph Bonanno to replace Cutler. The tapes also create a rift between Gotti and Sammy the Bull Gravano, where the Gambino boss described his newly appointed underboss as, quote, too greedy, and attempted to frame Sammy the Bull as the main force behind the murders of DiBernardo, Melito, and De Bono. Wow. Gotti's attempt at reconciliation failed, leaving Sammy the Bull disillusioned with the mob and doubtful on his chances of ever winning the case without Chargell, his former attorney. Gravano ultimately opted to turn state's evidence, formally agreeing to testify on November of 91. He was the highest-ranking member of a New York crime family to turn informer until Joseph Massino in 2003. Gotti's trial commenced with the prosecution's opening statements on February 12th. Andrew Maloney and John Gleason began their case by playing tapes showing Gotti discussing Gambino family business, including murders he approved, and confirming the animosity between Gotti and Castellano to establish motive to kill his boss. After calling a witness, the sparks hit who identified Carniglia as one of the men who shot Bellotti. Then they brought Sammy the Bull in to testify on March 2nd. On the stand, Sammy the Bull confirmed Gotti's place in the structure of the Gambino family and described in detail the conspiracy to assassinate Castellano, giving a full description of the hit and its aftermath. Sammy the Bull confessed to 19 murders, implicating Gotti on four of them. Krieger and Locascio's attorney, Anthony Cardinal, proved unable to shake Gravano during cross-examination. After additional testimony and tapes, the government rested its case on March 24th. Five of Krieger and Cardinal's intended six witnesses were ruled irrelevant or extraneous, leaving only Gotti's tax attorney, Murray Appleman, to testify on his behalf. I don't know. I think that sounds like they really wanted to make sure that Gotti went away forever. I see conspiracy in that. The defense also attempted, unsuccessfully, to have a mistrial declared based on Maloney's closing marks. Of the jurors, that they'd be less than human not to fear the man they're being asked to judge. Gotti himself became increasingly hostile during the trial, and at one point Glasser threatened to remove him from the court. Among other outbursts, Gotti called Sammy the Bull Gravano a junkie while his attorneys sought to discuss his past steroid use and equated the dismissal of a juror to the fixings of the 1919 World Series. I don't think John's wrong. I really don't. In April of 92, after only 14 hours of deliberation, the jury found Gotti guilty on all charges of the indictment. Locasciano was found guilty on all but one. James Fox, assistant director in charge of the FBI New York's field office, announced to the press at a conference, quote, "The Teflon is gone. The Don is covered with Velcro, and all the charges stuck," end quote. That's really a stupid... Oh, yeah, covered with Velcro. I just, you You know, when I heard that, to gloat like that, that was just, to me, less than professional. On June 23rd, 92, Glasser sentenced both defendants to life imprisonment without the possibility of parole and a $250,000 fine. Gotti was incarcerated at the U.S. Penitentiary in Marion, Illinois. He spent the majority of his sentence in solitary confinement, allowed out of his cell only for 1 hour a day. His final appeal was rejected by the U.S. Supreme Court in 94. In 96, a fellow inmate named Walter Johnson punched Gotti in the prison recreation room, leaving him bruised and bleeding because, according to New York Daily News, Gotti had disrespected him with a racial slur. Big surprise. Gotti, desiring revenge, offered the Aryan Brotherhood chieftains David Sakahian, Michael Michelini, somewhere between $40,000 and $400,000 to have Johnson killed in August. Johnson, however, was transferred to the Supermax prison in Florence, Colorado. Despite his imprisonment and pressure from the commission to stand down, Gotti asserted his prerogative to retain his title as boss until death or retirement, with his brother Peter and his son John relaying orders on his behalf. And also in 98, Gotti was diagnosed with throat cancer, and though the tumor was removed, the cancer was discovered to have returned 2 years later, and Gotti was transferred back to Springfield, where he spent the rest of his life. Against his father's wishes, John Jr. pled guilty and was sentenced to 6 years and 5 months imprisonment in 99, but due to, quote, circumstances, he served 11 years. I have a problem with that. He maintains he left the Gambino family. Peter Gotti subsequently became acting boss and is believed to have formally succeeded his brother shortly after Gotti's death. John Jr.'s indictment brought further stress to the Gotti marriage. Victoria, his mother, was unaware up to that point of her son's involvement in the mafia, blamed her husband for ruining her son's life, and threatened to leave him unless he allowed John Jr. to leave the mob. The last photo of John Gotti at age 60 was taken by the Bureau of Prisons October 17, 2001, 8 months before his death. Gotti's condition rapidly declined, and he died on June 10, 2002, at the age of 61. In an apparent repugnant action towards Gotti's leadership and legacy, the other New York City families sent no representatives to the funeral. Numerous prosecutions triggered by Gotti's tactics left the Gambinos decimated. By the turn of the century, half the family's made men were in prison. When we come back, I'm going to tell you why John Gotti just interests me in comparison to some of those other crime bosses. So stick around.